Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm your host, Ron Edwards. My co-host, Don Allen, is on assignment, traveling on the East Coast of the United States in the Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland area, if you will. So I will be your sole host this afternoon here on On Point. Beautiful day here in the Twin Cities, but it's not like it was a year ago. A year ago at this time in our beloved enclave, the temperatures were in the 60s. It's about 24 degrees out in downtown Minneapolis. A lot to talk about, a lot to reflect on, a lot to editorialize on. On today's program, we will be with you until 4. Again, I'm your co-host, Ron Edwards. My associate and colleague, Mr. Allen, is traveling. We want to take a look at the very top of this show at the international scene. And by the way, the phone line is available, 763-228-1748. 763-228-1748. That is the number for this afternoon's program, and that our technician, Mr. Allen, is not at the console, if you will. The situation in North Korea should be of significant interest and concern to all Americans, and it should be of concern to the rest of the world, if you will. The existence of significant belligerence, of course, between the United States and North Korea goes back more than 50 years. And it certainly has increased in the last number of years as the North Koreans have perfected their nuclear program and have indicated that the reason, the rationale, the logic for a nuclear program for North Korea are their suspicions of the intent of the United States. For many of those of you who are historians and experts on that part of the world, the Korean Peninsula, we all know that there has been a truce for, what is it now, going on 54 years. It was a part of the armistice of, when was it, 1953, so about 51 years. The North Koreans are said and identified by some as the mysterious kingdom, whatever that's supposed to mean. Their closest ally, of course, is China. We, quote-unquote, all know that. Its most significant enemy is the Western world, by and large, led by the United States, and, of course, the long-standing rancoredness between North Korea and South Korea. Two of the same people, but different ideologies, different philosophies, different politics, different sense of purpose and direction. Of course, that is not unique or peculiar or strange on this planet of ours. Other nations have had that same situation. In fact, the Germanys, which are now one for almost 50 years, saw that same kind of posturing, if you will, East Germany and West Germany, until the Berlin Wall came down and all those kinds of things. But it is North Korea today, tonight, this afternoon, tomorrow, and the coming weeks that has gotten the attention in a most serious manner of the United States. And so the announcement by Secretary, newly appointed Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, that the United States is going to spend another $1 billion. You see, one of the things that happens when people play at war is that there's money to be made. And so it is no accident that the United States is quickly announcing to a nation which is trying to do an economic recovery, put Americans back to work, and et cetera, that the United States is going to invest $1 billion in new missile interceptors, which, according to all the experts, only work about 50% of the time. In other words, in the number of years that these anti-missile systems have been in place in Alaska and along the West Coast, then only 50% of the time that they've been proficient in downing an incoming, quote-unquote, missile as a part of the war games that this country and other nations play, as as a part of defending the quote-unquote homeland. Of course, the American people really don't have much to say about the lack of detail and effectiveness of the intercept system. All you do is pay for it. In this case, it'll be $1 billion. And my sense is, as a journalist and a historian, is that within another year, we'll be told there'll be another $500 million that needs to be incorporated. And of course, you have cost overruns and et cetera as the new silos are prepared and retrofitted and et cetera, both in Alaska and along the west coast of the United States. And so this will be a significant financial package for the military-industrial complex, if you will, as these new intercepts are put into place. Of course, at the same time, the North Koreans, of course, with help from China, contrary to what is being said, Russia and others are attempting to do everything they can, they, the North Koreans, to enhance the technology of their missiles, both short range, medium range, and of course the long range, the ones that ultimately they maintain they will be able to threaten the United States of America with. Some experts indicate that the North Koreans are still a half a decade or a decade away from perfecting the kind of ballistic missile, ICBM, that could go even into the heartland beyond the west coast of the United States. Of course, there's not that much of a problem with respect to sending a missile across Japan, northward towards Alaska, and America's defense apparatus is there. But the key are the heavily populated areas of the west coast of the United States. And, of course, if one is to perfect a intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, that could penetrate the heartland and go as far into the United States as Salt Lake City and Denver and even here in Minneapolis and St. Paul, of course, that would be a significant concern, and rightly so, when one talks in terms of the damage. Of course, we have to understand in this society of ours that the only nation that has used nuclear power, quote-unquote, as a action to prevail in a war is, of course, the United States of America. And, of course, their targets were the Japanese as an outgrowth of the Second World War. We always wondered why America, given the enormous loss of life of American servicemen and servicewomen in the battle for Europe and specifically the battle for Germany in 1944 and 45, why the United States did not use a nuclear bomb on Berlin or Munich or places like that, if you know what we're saying. But our military and political decision was to use two nuclear devices on the Japanese, the little yellow people who had been involved in a sneak attack upon the United States of America on December 7th and 8th of 1941 in places like Hawaii and Wake Island and Midway and the Philippines, if you will, and attack, quote-unquote, our allies in Indochina and Malaysia and Singapore and Hong Kong and Indonesia and et cetera and et cetera. But the Germans were just as ruthless. Germans had been sinking American ships and et cetera without declaration of intent. American lives had been lost as far back as 1937, 38, and 39, really, with respect to the plan of the Nazis, quote unquote, to become the world's masters. And depending on who was present in the room, do you even share that as a part of the Axis powers, if you will, basically identified as Japan, Italy, and Nazi Germany? But historians have never really analyzed. You've never seen any made-for-TV series or made-for-the-movie theaters in which there has been this in-depth discussion with the Roosevelt administration and with Winston Churchill and the French government in exile about dropping nuclear bombs in Europe, if you will, and killing good Christians, white Christians, if you will. With the Japanese, it just wasn't that difficult. Of course, the other part that was difficult were the analysis of the casualties that American forces would take as they attempted to land, come ashore, and secure the Japanese home islands, if you will. History had shown that the Japanese were fiercely passionate about defending their ancestral homes, and so there were a lot of different figures that you see in the historical books, and etc. They're talking terms of as many as 2 million American dead, wounded, and etc. if there had been a commitment. And so two nuclear devices served the purpose, if you will, and it has always been a part of the big American saber, the United States and Russia, and then later the United States and Russia and China understood the importance of nuclear devices as a deterrent, if you will, to stop the other from making his mistake. Analysts, though, are now saying that the North Koreans may not be of the same mindset, if you will, politically or historically, as it pertains to the survival of the People's Republic of North Korea. These are questions and debates for, quote-unquote, the great minds of Washington and London and Moscow, if you will, and Berlin and et cetera. But the fact of the matter is that the North Koreans have shown, you know, since the days of their direct conflict with United States forces and so-called United Nations forces in North and South Korea, or other words, on the Korean Peninsula, the North Koreans have shown that they are not fearful, they're not terrified, they're not intimidated by the American military presence. And so we would suggest on this program of focus, if you will, that you keep an eye on this situation, because a misstep in this entire analysis, particularly with American and South Korean forces facing off so closely with North Korea's military presence on the peninsula, the North Koreans could initiate a preemptive strike, probably drive 75, 100, 150 miles inside of South Korea before America could even begin to mount a military response, to the extent that the North Koreans would, quote-unquote, begin to have second thoughts about their actions. Again, also, and we hear a lot of reflections by our America's military experts, and particularly her admirals and generals, that if the North Koreans were to make a mistake like that, they would be annihilated, and etc. Well, no one has said that they have a guarantee that China will stand by as American nuclear, quote-unquote, capabilities are arraigned and rained down upon North Korea. The Chinese have a common border with North Korea, as does the Russians, by the way. And one has to understand the anxiety that both China and Russia in that order would begin to suffer through if, quote-unquote, the United States would have no choice if there is even a conventional attack on American forces in South Korea, what the response and thinking would be. Our sense is, in the words of the late General Douglas MacArthur, who wanted to nuke the North Koreans and the Chinese, if you will, luckily President Harry Truman thought that that was not a very good idea, in quote-unquote consideration of maintaining world order and world peace. But this North Korean situation is one that I'm afraid our experts here do not read well. One of the things that come into play continuously is the slight bias based on nationality and race that, quote-unquote, the United States are better thinkers, more intellectual, along with their European colleagues in understanding the little mysterious Oriental mind. Bad move. That was shown with respect to the beginning of the Second World War and miscalculating and misreading the sanctions and et cetera that were being taken against the Japanese. And it certainly increased with respect to what the North Koreans would do after, quote-unquote, the United States began to deploy a significant military presence in South Korea, and what the Chinese would do when they came swarming across the Yeouu and actually almost forced the United States back into the Yellow Sea and the quote-unquote Sea of Japan. Unfortunately, no one is honest enough to indicate what it is that really governs, generates, drives their thinking with respect to dealing with other people who are, quote-unquote, as they like to say, not like us. Now, by the way, as an African-American, I clearly know they're not talking about African-Americans. They don't see us as having a minimal understanding of the complexities, if you will, of world events and foreign affairs and et cetera. We're just here to, you know, be requested to be volunteers, or if there's a draft going on, to be drafted. So the sons and daughters of the African give their life in support and defense, quote unquote, of democracy. So there's an interesting scenario, as we basically spent about 14 minutes on this particular issue, the Far East, North Korea. By the way, I think that it was really shoddy of the Obama administration and others to malign Dennis Rodman. He gained, quote-unquote, more of a audience, if you will, with the power brokers and leadership of North Korea than all of these individuals who are trained as diplomats and who we are told has the tremendous capabilities of knowing how to deal with people, how to negotiate with them, how to analyze them, and et cetera. Dennis Rodman went to North Korea as a part of actually the filming of a documentary, talking in terms of basketball and the North Korean people's interest and curiosity and even love of the game of basketball, and particularly the American version. But it was interesting to watch the attacks on Dennis Rodman. Again, so much of that was predicated upon race, though no one has the hearts, the guts, the intestinal fortitude, same thing, to confirm that and admit that, if you will. So as we said just minutes ago, North Korea back on the agenda. That takes us very quickly to Iran. Iranians indicating that they're not intimidated, terrified, and that though the sanctions are having a greater effect maybe in Iran than they are in North Korea, of course, Iran being a much larger country with, quote-unquote, a more stable economic base than the North Koreans, at least that's what's alleged, that the Iranians are letting it be known that they intend to move ahead with their quest for a nuclear program. And, you know, everyone knows that the Iranians certainly are going to militarize their nuclear capabilities. And in some respects, why not? There needs to be a balance of power in the Middle East amongst Muslim, quote-unquote, both Persian and Arab countries to offset the presence of nuclear capabilities, which has been there now for 20 years with the Israelis, if you will. You know, it's amazing in this country how when dissecting problems with the Palestinians and with Hezbollah and other elements, quote-unquote, of the conflict in that part of the world, that no one ever talks about Israel's nuclear capabilities, which, of course, were handed to them on a silver platter by the United States and, to a lesser degree, the British, if you will, but particularly the United States, so that the Israelis had a doomsday device, if you will. And that doomsday device, of course, was to be able to point nuclear missiles at the capitals of the Arab countries there in the Middle East. Oops, no one likes to talk about that. The Egyptians have known for a long time that there are Israeli nuclear missiles pointed towards Cairo, if you will. The Syrians knew there were nuclear missiles pointed towards Damascus, if you will. There are nuclear missiles under the control of the Israelis pointed towards Beirut, if you will. Certainly, they were pointed towards Baghdad before the conflicts of Desert Storm 1 and Desert Storm 2. In fact, Israeli nuclear missiles are also pointed towards a, you know, great longtime American ally, Saudi Arabia, and specifically the Saudi oil fields, which, by the way, if damaged, would have a severe and significant impact on America's quote-unquote economic future, economic recovery, and et cetera. These are things you never hear the experts talk about. And by the way, as we said before, the phone line is open, 763-228-1748. One of our clandestine numbers, if you will. Anyone has any questions or observations, feel free to call us, 763-228-1748. Again, I am Ron Edwards, co-host of the program that also involves my colleague, Mr. Donald Allen, who is in Washington, D.C., the center of indecision, rancoredness, disorganization, lack of unity, and et cetera. You know, sometimes when people refer to Washington, D.C., and we'll be back to the Middle East, don't worry about it, when they refer to the Beltway, when they talk about Washington, it's kind of a glib term. I wonder if people ever thought about the fact that the Beltway actually is strangling the democratic institutions of America to death. Think about that when you hear people talk about the Beltway of Washington, D.C. Yeah, that Beltway and all of the institutions and organizations and things that it represents is strangling democracy. In some regards, by the way, you have to feel for President Barack Obama, because even though he, by constitutional, mandate and et cetera, will not be able to succeed himself, this is a part of what is called the Roosevelt Doctrine, he will only be allowed to serve two terms. It is quite clear that the Republicans and the extreme right wing in this country are just dedicated, if you will, committed with a passion to leave him no legacy but a negative legacy, and to do nothing to allow his administration to have even minimal success other than what the quote-unquote extreme right wing in this country dictates to be acceptable success by a African-American president. And that's another thing that we don't talk about in this country, that Mitch McConnell and others are so driven by the color of this president's skin, the hue, if you will, of his complexion, that they are obsessed, almost to the verge of insanity, really. Yes, they are. I mean, some are almost deranged with respect to their obsession and hatred of dealing with this man who happens to be black, but more importantly, he is the president of the United States of America. And anything that these people can do, these extreme right-wingers, these tea partiers, if you will, we call them teabaggers, if you will, anything that they can do to hurt the American public, at the same time use some kind of justification to continue to undermine this president, that they will do and are doing as even as we speak. And so our colleague is in the Washington, Baltimore area, and we just hope that he does not find himself caught up in the strangling, if you will, that represents what the Beltway is really all about. Quickly go back to the Middle East. The president, by the way, is preparing to make his first venture to Israel, if you will. The power of the Jewish lobby here in the United States insisted, if you will, that he show loyalty, though an American president is required only to show loyalty to the Constitution and to the people of the United States. But we all know that President Barack Obama has been pressured, even by some of his closest advisors, to show loyalty and deference. Notice the word deference and respect to Israel. And Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, who was able to squeak through another term, if you will. That's one of the advantages of coalition governments or parliamentary governments, as people like to reflect on and talk about. I don't know, maybe in some regards we would do better in governance here in the United States if we had a parliamentary form of government. That certainly would have given African Americans a more significant and balanced role in being able to have a say about, quote-unquote, our destiny, our future, our health, if you will, if we could have been a part of coalitions over the last 80 years or so. particularly after we were allowed back into the Congress of the United States. Oh, yes, for those of you in our international audience, you have to understand there was a period from 1901 to 1924 that the Negro, the African-American, whose sons and daughters, well, particularly her sons, were dying in the great First World War, but even before that in the conflict in the Philippines, the Spanish-American War, all those conflicts, young Negroes gave their lives, if you will. At that time, wore blue uniforms. But in World War I, the doughboys, if you will, giving their last blood in defense of democracy upon returning to these democratic shores, found out it was business as usual. It wasn't until 1925. 24 years went by before a Negro, quote-unquote, was allowed to take a seat in the Congress of the United States, if you will. A Republican, by the way. The gentleman, Oscar DePriez, was elected out of the South Side of Chicago as a Republican. Goes to show you how things change. In 1932, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt became the President of the United States of America. In many respects, we, the Negro race, the Negro people, loved, quote-unquote, the Republicans because of Abraham Lincoln, who, of course, we were just given a partial description of what Abraham Lincoln's real thinking was about the issue of slavery, what the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 was all about, and even the decisions that were made after the quote-unquote surrender of the Confederacy, a group of significant traitors, if you will, in 1865, there's really never been the kind of honest examination of the real thinking of President Lincoln and quote-unquote his administration. But hey, that's all a part of why Black America finds herself on the bottom rung, if you will, the bottom ladder of the political and social and even the religious, if you will. By the way, congratulations to the Latino Hispanic contingency of the world. They now have a pope, if you will, though he is of, well, his parents were Italian, if you will, but born in Argentina. Calls himself now an Argentinian and calls himself now Francis, if you will, in deference and respect for Francis of Assisi, if you will. But at some point, maybe in another 200 years, the Vatican and the cardinals, if you will, coming together to elect a pope, maybe 150, 200 years from now, will finally decide that a black man from Africa, because, boy, I'm telling you, if there's ever been a group of Catholics that have been loyal and obedient and have given everything that they've had to the Catholic Church, it has been Black Mother Africa, if you will. So maybe in 150, 200 years, we will have, for the first time in 700 or 800 years, a black pope.
Mr.
There are
Edwards,
people out there that
Mr.
consider
Edwards.
Themselves to be on top. Yes.
Hey, I'm sorry for disturbing you. This is Don Allen calling live. Well,
hi, Don. How are you doing? Glad to hear from you. We're able to break away there in the political.
I'm here listening to the show with about 9 or 10 people here. I really told them, I said, you have to listen to Mr. Edwards and our show. I'm not on today, but you were talking a few minutes about politics and the Republicans and the Tea Parties and how, and just now you just finished with a very good point, and this is the conversation we were having. I flew into D.C. yesterday, and I just want to share this with you real quick because I have a few minutes.
Go right ahead, Don. Go right ahead. This is my co-host, Don Allen, calling in from Washington-Baltimore area. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, and so I flew into D.C. yesterday, and Mr. Edwards, I walked. I'm actually here on the twofold mission, and I want to let people know that I'm meeting with some African philosophers and under the guidance of a local university here, and also attending some events with my wife. And so we've had some really great conversations, but one of the things that they kind of, and I'm a rookie here in the group, and so I was thinking yesterday, Friday, walking through the airport and seeing Somalians, immigrants, working at cash registers, working at out on the field putting luggage on the planes, doing the janitorial work behind the flight desk, and just and white people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Not just Somalian, East African, immigrant, you know,
mm-hmm.
all these great jobs. The airport is a job. They pay pretty well.
Oh, yes, it is, yes.
Okay, and then I had to think back to the 70s when my dad would take us and the family to Jamaica, to Florida, to California, Disneyland, Italy World, and go all over the place. And I said, you know what, I saw black American men and women working at that airport.
Okay,
I did it. I saw, you know, hello. It's a hello. And the black man that shined the shoes in front of the Minneapolis Public Airport there, he had a shoe shine stand right in front for years. And from the 60s into the 70s, okay?
And they took it from
That figure is no longer out there. Now, we fly into Washington yesterday. First thing off the plane, the paper. A young man, graduate from a local college here, is shot dead going into his door. 2:30 in the morning, it's not unusual to see 10 or 15, 20 black folks in an area equivalent to North Minneapolis out shooting at cars driving by.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what hit me hard today is we drove from D.C. to Baltimore. We got into Baltimore, downtown, beautiful, Inner Harbor. They all fixed up the Children's Museum, restaurants, just gorgeous.
Lovely restaurants there, by the way. Seafood,
yes.
Some of the best in the world. Gotcha.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Less than 10 minutes outside of downtown, about 4 miles, we drove through 4 miles of boarded up buildings, row houses, projects like that were in off Folsom Highway in North Minneapolis, boarded up though.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And just the black people there was a lady in the street in front of the 7-Eleven begging for money. Yeah, she could have been on the hustle, but she was begging. And I looked in her eyes, and I could read people pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I went in my pocket and pulled out some, you know, I said, here, eat something to eat. Tears started falling down her eyes. This is
mm-hmm.
a black American woman. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I came to the conclusion, Mr. Edwards, is that black Americans are being edited out of America. Okay.
Yes, sir. We concur. Yes, absolutely.
Yes. And if what happens here in Baltimore, what I've seen here in Baltimore, and just all these, it's coming to where we are there in Minnesota. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to freeze us out. The violence here is the same violence they're having there until they have to board up these places. And it's easy for the European to walk in and have his way. And this place is so close to Washington, D.C., and the government, you figure out how is this going on. And you can see this in Detroit. You see this in Chicago going off the hook. You can see this places in Houston, California, and out on the East Coast. This place is a disaster. Well, one gentleman tells me here that it hasn't recovered since the riots.
That's correct, and it's kind of like the mentality is to, and of course this mentality obviously has been going on for over 40 years, to
mm-hmm.
punish black America for calling attention to the plights that black America was suffering through in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, if you will, and just before you tapped in. You know,
yeah.
We were talking in terms of the feeling and the disposition of African Americans who've served this country, such as yourself, Mr. Allen. You are a veteran of the armed forces of the United States of America. And I look around me in my travels also, and it's just clear that we are being logged out, if you will. If I just would share with your group there, as well as our listeners, in my column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, I have a headline which says, "When will Minnesota's No Black Workers Need Apply Policy End?" And the sub-headline is, "Minnesota keeps letting non-black races, creeds, organizations, women, and other interest groups cut into the head of the line, forcing black workers to stay at the back of the bus." And Mr. Allen and myself, in doing this program, have talked about that. I think, Mr. Allen, you know, you should share with your guests there, if they've not heard this program before. We have received some very interesting calls over the last 4 months or so since
mm-hmm.
we re-engage this blog radio program. I think maybe more and more people are African Americans are beginning to see what some of those of us who are part of the old guard have been saying here over the last decade, that, you know, we are an endangered species.
And yeah, yeah.
Black males are definitely an endangered species in quote unquote America the Beautiful. And I have so much respect for Harriet Belafonte, and I encourage people to reflect upon his statements upon receiving the, I guess it was the NAACP's Freedom Award at the Image, where he talked about what our quote-unquote leaders are not doing. And, you know, pretty soon our leaders won't have to worry about doing anything because they won't have a constituent base. There won't be any of us left. Anything else, Mr. Allen, in your,
well,
in your journey?
Well, I'm going to take off. I'm heading back down to downtown Baltimore, but I just want to chime in on that and let you know. And it's a great show. They're going to finish listening here while I hop in the vehicle and head out.
All right. Thank you, sir, and the best. And be safe to your guests and associates there in Baltimore, Washington. Washington. Thank you, sir. All right.
Okay, bye.
That was co-host Donald Allen of this program calling in on point, if you will, a program which focuses on the position, if you will, the events surrounding the struggle by Black America to maintain some kind of parity. We don't even use that word anymore, do we? Parity. Mr. Allen, in the Washington, D.C., Baltimore area for a couple of Pacific events. He pointed out that he is meeting with some scholars at some local universities there dealing with African and Pan-African and Afro-American leadership history, if you will, specifically. I assume that they'll also be talking about economics because, you know, we are really in the back of the bus trying to catch up economically. You know, Mr. Allen brings forward some frightening observations as he talked about his arrival in Washington, D.C. at the Washington airport. He talks in terms of what he has seen. Washington, a city that still, I do believe, is probably about 65-70% African-American, used to be, in which you see so few African-Americans, sons and daughters of the African brought here in bondage, you see so few of them in positions of, you know, employment, even in positions of power, if you will. And we see the same thing here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, which promotes itself, notice the word we use, promotes itself as a great liberal enclave of great thinkers, great reflectors, and et cetera. And yet this is one of the worst possible areas that one can live in here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul for a Black person who isn't just degreed to the maximum to even find any kind of work, any job, any career, if you will. You know, now, of course, if you have a doctoral degree, if you have a master's in certain disciplines, if you will, and even a bachelor's or associate bachelor's in a certain degree, you will be able to find something, if you will. But God help you if it's only a high school diploma. And God help you if you really have a dream and ambition to work those kinds of jobs in which you know your white counterparts have worked these jobs, have been filtered into these jobs, and are able to talk in terms of two or three generations of their family that have worked in this particular discipline, particularly the construction industries, if you will, industries like everything from baking, you know, owning a bake shop, if you will, to working in the breweries, if you will, to working in the railroad yards, to working in certain even soft commercial areas and et cetera, you know, you kind of get grandfathered in. And you know, kind of reminds me of feather bedding. It used to be something they used to do in the old days of the railroad. And all this talk always about the unions. The unions haven't looked out after Black people since probably the end of the Second World War. That's a long time ago. And so for those that can always call these programs up on demand, you know, we encourage you to do that. You'll be able to hear the consistent flavor of the two commentators, the two co-hosts, Mr. Allen and Mr. Edwards. That doesn't make us reflect or represent the apex of intellect and intelligence on the face of the planet. But we are doing something that's fairly rare on this program, that we have been gifted and blessed enough to be able to at least have our voices heard beyond two or three people, if you will, you know. And that is to call attention to those things that we hear so many of those who are part of, quote unquote, the common masses, as folks like to say. I always refer to it as a 74-year-old African American, as those who are the occupants of the South 40. That was always the worst part of the plantation, where, quote unquote, the Negro slaves, housing and shacks and et cetera, were put closest to the swamp, if there was one, the closest to the mosquitoes, the closest to the worst possible water, if you will, creating the worst possible conditions for hygiene and et cetera. The South 40, as we used to refer to it. Mr. Allen points out in his reflections just a couple minutes ago, all the boarded up properties and et cetera in Baltimore. But see, it's not just Baltimore, it's Baltimore, it's Washington, it's Philadelphia, it's Pittsburgh, it's Columbus, it's Cincinnati, it's Louisville, it's Memphis, if you will, it's Nashville, it's Chattanooga, it's Atlanta, which is, you know, supposedly considered to be the paradise for the development of the black intelligentsia and the black network of prosperity and specifically vision, if you will. Even in the Sugar Lands of the Floridas, if you will, be it Jacksonville or Tampa, St. Petersburg or Orlando or Miami and et cetera, there's always these neighborhoods which now have a full contingent of black Americans, the sons and daughters of the African who were brought here in chains, that we are now the occupants of continued poverty and despair. I hate to say it to those that are certainly listening and are part of the contingent in the Washington and Baltimore area, but you know, really, the example of prosperity in Black America has really become, and I have an appreciation for those with professional skills. My own grandfather on my father's side was a physician of medicine, graduating from Mahara way back in 1912, practicing, doing his graduate work here at the University of Minnesota in 1914. So I have all deference and respect to those African Americans that have worked their behinds off, male and female, to achieve the letters and degrees and et cetera. But the fact of the matter is that the economic base in Black America are athletes, musicians, and dope and drug dealers. You know what I mean? We don't really own a single big Fortune 500 American corporation. Well, we now periodically are accorded the opportunity to have an African American, primarily a male, become the chief executive officer, CEO for a period of time. But I've said for years, for over 50 years, that I'm just fascinated by the fact that, I mean, we don't own a GE, we don't own a Westinghouse, you know, we don't own a Philip Morris. We don't own an airline. We don't even own a media network. You know, let me tell the inside joke that these days. You would think that NBC, the Negro Broadcasting Corporation, would be ours, if you will. I mean, really, in many respects, as it pertains to the big money, the big fortunes, and et cetera, we in Black America. And you got to realize, my friends, how long we've been here. It's not like we just came over on the boat, if you will. It's not like we just discovered, quote unquote, the Americas, you know, 400 years after the guy called Christopher for Columbus. I mean, we've been here since those days, if you will, since the 1400s, if you will. Probably if we ever got a correct reflection of the real history of this planet, the seagoing traffic and trade between South America and Mother Africa and et cetera, we'll probably find out that the African, if you will, was setting foot on the shores of South America and vice versa as early as at least 1400 to 1500 BC, in other words, 1400 years or more before Christ. Some of that is reflected in some of the writings and archives and et cetera, which basically were plundered from both Africa and from South America / Central America and North America, oftentimes by the church, though some of these documents, if you will, and documentations are in vaults and crypts and et cetera. It's all a part of something that is not allowed to really be discussed. The accurate description, the real history of this world that we reside in. You know, folks would have us believe that some way or another we didn't even know how to make fire. You know, we didn't know how to forge steel, if you will, in some regards, because they are more in control of their historical reflections and et cetera. The Asian, particularly led by China and Japan, have done a much better job of dismissing and destroying those myths, if you will, about the lack, quote unquote, of intervention and innovation and et cetera. And when we say intervention, we mean to the extent that great empires existed and they were involved in intervention, if you will, on behalf of their own kind as they swept across the lands that they were in close proximity to. And the same thing, no one can explain the example. I mean, they're still trying to explain the pyramids, okay, but they're also trying to explain, quote unquote, the great lost cities that are being found each and every month and every year in the Andes and in the jungles, the rich jungles of the Amazon and et cetera, and the great cities of Central America and et cetera, and the enclaves whose history goes back 5,000 years or more, right here in the plains and the prairies and the Grand Canyons of the United States of America. But as long as our history is suppressed, then one will not have an appreciation of what Mr. Allen just said about 15 minutes ago about the beginning of the disappearance of the African American, the sons and daughters of the African in this country of ours, if you will. If the drugs don't kill us off, then the intentional, with malice and forethought, suppression of our ability to try to grow, to try to have, as we like to say, in fact, one of our books has that title, A Place at the Table of Opportunity, and et cetera. And so it is important that these discussions be generated. As we said, unfortunately, we don't control anything. You know, you think in terms of the Heritage Foundation and think tanks and et cetera. We really don't have a single think tank, if you will. I know as a younger black man, as a younger Negro coming out of the 1950s and 60s, many of us, as a part of our discussions of the revolution, if you will, and talking in terms of taking our rightful place once again, because there was a point in time, 60, 70, 80 years before, that the Negro was moving towards, quote-unquote, their rightful place. But then that dream was destroyed with respect to the black codes, if you will. And we repeat again that piece of history we shared with you about, and this is primarily for our international audience, but, you know, for those that have been locally educated, that we were denied an opportunity to sit in the Congress, in the House of Democracy, if you will, the Congress of the United States, the Senate and the House of Representatives for 24 years, really, from basically 1901 until 1925, in January of 1925, when Oscar DeFreeze, a Republican from the South Side of Chicago, was allowed to return. In fact, for some of you that are scholars and et cetera, you may want to research the Negro papers of that particular day, particularly in Chicago, if you will. You may want to take a look at some of the writings by young men such as Herbert White, a young reporter in a place called St. Paul named Roy Wilkins. You may want to take a look at some of the things they said in regards to the return of the Negro to the people's house, if you will. That's something that really is not talked about with the depth, the reflection that would be so important to make our children, our heirs, if you will, our future, if one thinks strongly in those terms, that we have had a significant role. You know, I grow so tired and weary of those who are newly arrived in this land of ours, who disrespect us as the African American, making statements and reflecting in their demeanor towards us that we did not fight to break our way out of bondage, if you will. Millions of black people who were brought to this land in shackles died so that there could be a future for those that came after them, and etc. But it is the disrespect that is shown us as the African American by others who come here and really should know different and should know better, if you will, that we fought and we fought well and we fought the battle and we gave the lives and we lost many leaders that maybe if they had been allowed to live and maybe we had gone another direction, we maybe would have had the kind of institutions that we were just reflecting on minutes ago. But quote unquote, we have no control over that. That is history, that is past. But there were great reflectors, I like to say. But for those of you that are really interested in that period from 1901 to 1925, January of 1925, take a look at Oscar Staten de Preece. He lived from 1871 to 1951, United States representative from 1929 to 1935, if you will. Take a look at that history. Take a look at what happened, if you will. Take a look at the contest in Chicago and how difficult it was when Oscar de Preece indicated that he wanted to run for a legislative seat, a House of Representatives seat on the south side of Chicago. What happened, how it happened, if you will, how he had to deal with the white political bosses, Big William Hale, Big Bill Thompson, and a longtime United States representative for the Negro race, Martin Madden, and etc. These are pieces that have been lost to us and been denied to us. It makes a significant, important piece about our return to the people's house, if you will. Why is it important? Because it shows that just as we fought to receive it, if you will, we lost it because we were beaten down. The federal government decided not to protect us, not to look after us, not to, quote-unquote, do the things that needed to be done to allow us our rightful place. And in fact, you know, for those of you that really are concerned and for those of you that have been representatives, quote-unquote, of the search for accurate history, go back and take a look at the departure of the last, quote-unquote, Negro on the occasion of his departure from the House of Representatives of the United States Congress as he was being spat upon and ridiculed and cursed and etc. and being told to get out of the white man's house and etc. Just, if you get a chance, you know, just take a look at it. Analyze it. It's a part of history that should send a shiver through those of us who maintain that we are concerned about, quote-unquote, the future of the African-American. You know, there are some of you out there that have brought young children into this world and are about to bring young children into this world and such things as that. And all mothers, all fathers in that order always like to think that there is a future, if you will, a positive future, that a path can be blazed, if you will, so that their heirs, that's important, their heirs, Because, you know, in many respects, there's no one who is as staunch a defender of the right of their, quote-unquote, heirs to succeed and to enjoy the benefits of the great nation, et cetera, than white America. And in many respects, they showed that. They reflected on that during both the campaigns of 2008 and 2012. They let it be known, you know, that this is their nation, if you will. And when we as black people, who, as I said before, certainly by record have been here since the 1630s and 1640s, talk in terms of our nation and our dreams and our ambitions and our concerns and reflections for, quote-unquote, our future, that we are some way or another dismissed as not having the intellectual depth, the knowledge, and certainly the strategy for how we shall, quote-unquote, prevail and be allowed to, quote-unquote, enjoy all vestiges of the great American dream. And so that's what a program like that, as we near the conclusion of today's program, if you will, in the last 4.5 minutes, that is what a program like this is about. And also, let me say, we were kind of telling a joke, but really we weren't. When we talked about, you know, we don't even have a television network, you know. We really don't have a radio, quote-unquote, network. We really don't have the mechanism that would allow us the opportunity to communicate and et cetera. And by the way, for those of you that reflect upon it, keep in mind this date, December 5th, 1887, statement from the articles of the Congressional Record. On December 5th, 1887, for the first time in almost 2 decades, Congress convened without an African-American member. Now, later, some blacks were to stagger back to the Congress of the 51st Congress. That would have been 1889 to 1891. The number of Negroes or African-Americans diminished significantly as the Congress focused on racial equality began to fade. So if you get a chance, you know, think about some of those great men, Thomas Miller, George Murray, John M. Langston of Virginia, and George White of North Carolina. In fact, for those of you who'd like to do a little research, get on your computer and call up the congressman from North Carolina, George White. Take a look at, quote-unquote, what is entitled The Negro's Temporary Farewell and the statements by the last Negro member at that time until 20-some years later, the last Negro to be allowed to serve in the Congress of the United States of America. We repeat this again. We know it sounds a little redundant, but then we don't apologize for redundancy if redundancy is a part of an alert, a red flag, if you will, an announcement, a bulletin that talks in terms of the future and, quote-unquote, the continued existence of the race. So we want to thank you for tuning in, and we want to thank you for, we hope, the reflections that we have generated in this today's program, if you will. We'll be back with you next Saturday. Mr. Allen will be joining us after, as we said, a temporary trip out to the nation's capital, the place of confusion and non-activity and non-performance. This has been Ron Edwards. This has been another edition of On Point, coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Black America, continue to stay strong, and let us offer prayers for our people and ourselves. God knows we will need them. Good afternoon, and we'll see you next Saturday.